Should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options.
So electrified looks different for everyone.
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified diversified.
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Robert Siegel, welcome to the Atlantic Interview.
Thank you, Jeff.
I know this is the big time.
I finally made
so
it.
So I don't want you to be nervous. Actually, the truth is, I'm a little bit nervous. I've never done this with you in this direction.
We've done it in the other direction.
Which is nerve-wracking in itself. But we're very pleased that you chose to spend part of your first day of retirement with us. Robert Siegel, as all of you know, is host for, I think it was 67 years.
Almost,
All things considered. Joined NPR in 1904. But I wanted to ask you, why retire now? And there's two parts to that question. One is, we happen to be in an extraordinary political moment.
Yeah.
It's fun for you to cover. As a journalist, at least, it's fun. Maybe as a citizen, it's fraught. Mm-hmm. And the second is, and this is going to sound strange, but you still have your voice. What is it that made you think you should retire?
Well, I decided to do this about 3.5 years ago. When I figured that I would be – originally it was supposed to happen at the end of June of last year. I would turn 70, and that seemed about right to me as a time for change. I could do it longer, but at some point I would start doing it worse. I don't know when that would happen. I know that it's harder for me. I'm not suffering from any ailments or the like, but it's harder for me to remember names today than it was 10, 20 years ago. And I'm still fine. I can do it. But I don't want to reach a point where I have to stop doing it because I can't. And I feel like I'm doing it when whatever I do the rest of my life, I'm still reasonably young at 70 and robust and ready to do something else rather than feel that I couldn't do anything else.
Have you seen people stay in their careers in journalism or in radio specifically too long?
I think so.
What is this?
I don't want to, you know, go into
I'm not asking you name
but,
names, but
no, but I mean, you know, you don't want to reach a point where your editor is finding that you're mentioning the wrong president all the time, or that you're getting dates wrong, basic dates.
You've said that that in politics you've stayed current, but you feel a little bit as if the culture is escaping you.
Yeah, the popular
Talk
culture
about
is.
That.
I don't quite understand the aesthetic of a lot of popular music today, or also I think taste in movies is probably different from what mine is, a mass taste. And I have to remember to put this in the past tense. Mm-hmm. I would take part in a meeting with lots of people who are half my age or younger than that. And they were all hooked into social media in similar ways, and in ways that I found uninteresting and unnecessary. And they knew about performers and phenomena that I just don't know anything about.
But just to play devil's advocate for a minute, you're a journalist, you're a reporter, you're not supposed to know everything. You're supposed to talk to people who do know
that's
things.
That's right. You're right, and I could bone up on something, and I can watch videos, and I can read up and lean on younger staffers for support. But, I didn't feel I haven't felt for the past couple of years that that I understand the country culturally the way I once thought I did. Politically, I feel pretty sharp about it.
We'll come to politics in a minute, but stay on culture. Is it that you don't like where the culture is going?
It's not even like. I mean, I'm saying this as the father of a singer-songwriter. Hip-hop culture is beyond me. I just don't I don't quite get it. And I was somebody who was a top 40 disc jockey in college as much as a newscaster. I'm not coming at this from the perspective of high culture. I just don't, I don't quite get what it is that,
right.
I was at a wedding recently at which a young couple was getting married and most of the music drew all of the younger people to the stage to dance. And at some point, somebody put the Jackson 5 and I Want You Back on it. Everybody came out. And it was sort of, some point that we all, everybody in the room had that in common. But until that point, I didn't have any sense of what was going on.
Go to the politics question for a minute, because I understand why you would want to get out on top, which you've done with all your faculties and your robustness. Mm-hmm. By the way, I don't associate the word robust with Robert Siegel, but I'm willing to go with this. Erudite, thoughtful,
ambulatory. I'll go with ambulatory.
Ambulatory. Okay, let's settle on ambulatory.
It's a more modest level of robustness.
Right. Can walk.
Right.
But the political moment must be awfully hard for you to walk away from this unusual period in American history.
In theory, it should be, and I think I would have said that. So far, I can't say that I'm.
I want to point out that so far is
that I'm feeling the pangs.
24 hours.
That's all. That's right. Maybe it'll feel different in a while. I worked at NPR for all those years in a place that's dense with talent, and I leave those concerns to my very able colleagues. I find that. You know, I'm looking forward to a few days of not thinking about Donald Trump. You know, that would be kind of nice.
You started in journalism in college, and you started in journalism at a fraught time, similarly fraught time, the late 60s. And I remember you saying once that you were relieved to have been a college journalist covering campus uprisings because you didn't want to participate in the tumult. I'm wondering what you think about the media today, the desire or the decision by a lot of media outlets to more or less join the, quote, resistance. I have to assume that this is not something that would have sat well with you had your colleagues said, let's be more activist.
No, it would not have sat. I can't imagine. Some of my most junior young colleagues might have thought or said such a thing, but I can't imagine many others saying that. Look, I think the institutions of a democratic society are very important. A free press is one of them. Independent broadcasting is one of them. And in the tumult of the Trump presidency, I think it would be disastrous if all institutions decided that tradition and history don't matter anymore. We have to join in this resistance. We wouldn't have the strong institution standing at the end of that. And there will be an end of this period. You know, this is not...
You're not a pessimist about the inevitable decline?
Well, I'm not a pessimist about the inevitable decline. I think that...
Is that because you went through the 60s?
Maybe. I agreed. I was once interviewing Biden on his as he was wrapping up his term, and I agreed with him absolutely. 1968, this country was much more divided than it was in 2016, or I would extend it now to 2017. We were having not just deep cultural divisions, riots in the streets. George Wallace was running polling double digits for the presidency, not with dog whistles. I mean, being essentially an anti-integrationist or a back to segregationist, whatever we would say. Richard Nixon was taking advantage of this to get elected. The old systems that had kept people civil and well behaved in politics were falling away in some way that we weren't able to describe then and there. So I thought those days were much, much more divisive and scary. So far, I don't think that the Trump administration has done to any journalist or news organization what Richard Nixon did to my old colleague Dan Shore when they started an FBI investigation of him. That's a fairly low bar for grading an administration. But so far, I don't feel that that every administration from here on in is going to be intent on insulting everyone in sight and challenging every news report as a lie and whatever. And I think that. I don't think that's whatever is popular about this presidency among some people. It's not that stuff. So,
what was the impulse in the 60s that kept you on the sidelines, made you an observer and not a participant, and made you happy, made you being an observer for the last 40 plus years in radio?
I wasn't much of an activist. In high school, I did join the local a chapter of the Friends of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and took part in food drives in Manhattan to send down to people in Mississippi.
You aren't building bombs in Greenwich Village basements.
No. I sort of dropped out of the SNCC business when there was some big civil rights demonstration that included people whom I did not agree with at all. I wasn't built for marching if it meant marching with people whom I only agreed with about one thing and thought they were odious in other respects. So I was not a college activist. I think it would have been, for me, a very out of character to go sit in a building and await arrest.
Right. By the way, how's my interviewing technique so far?
It's great, Jeff. It's really terrific.
Really?
Yes.
I think you're just saying that because it's my show.
It's very probing.
It's quite nerve-wracking because you're very good at interviewing. And I wanted to talk to you about interviewing a little bit, just as a tradecraft. Well, first, let me do it because I'm a negative person. Let me start with the negative.
Yeah.
Can you remember an interview that you did on All Things Considered that you just thought, this is a terrible interview?
Oh, I mean, there have been many, and I've put them out of
I'm trying to dredge up bad memories. Yeah,
but we have to remember about All Things Considered that they are very recorded and edited programs, so that an interview that I typically do that you hear on the air. It might be 6 minutes of that. That might be quite long, cut out of 25 minutes in the studio, or if things were really going badly, out of 35, 40 minutes in the studio.
But you did live. I mean, I've been
on
your show live.
Yes, we have done live interviews. But that was a sign of our enormous confidence in you, Jeff, that you were housebroken as a guest on the program.
And, obviously.
And that you would not run on forever.
I had gone through your re-education program.
Yes, lots of interviews that, as I think a lot of interviewers know, one of the worst tip-offs is when the guest is either mentioning your name or the title of his or her book in every answer. That person has been coached by someone to do that, and your challenge is to try to.
That's a good point, Robert. Coaching.
That's right. That's right, Jeff.
Politicians,
yeah,
very, very
terrible,
hard.
Terrible.
What are the secrets to success in interviewing a politician?
I'm not sure I know. I mean,
if you don't know, then nobody knows. No, so try harder.
You have to be armed in there. You have to anticipate what the obvious answers are going to be and be armed with the rebuttals to those answers so that you're there pretty quickly after the politician has said what he has to say, because they'll try to get it on the air no matter what you do.
There's a lot of criticism of reporters in the Trump era who, the criticism goes, turn on their tape recorders in front of the president and let him go.
Yeah.
Talk about the role of the interviewer, the reporter, in these circumstances. I know what side of this debate I'm on, but I'm curious to know if you've thought about this criticism that a lot of people have been getting.
I think we're there at some level as Truth Squad members. You know, if we're hearing outright falsehoods go by, while there's something delectable about saying, "Whoa, this guy just got he got a whopper out of the president in that interview." It's actually important for people listening to the interview who are not journalists, who are not keeping score on everything that politicians are saying, to be prepared to say, but that's not you. You said the exact opposite on here. Let's go back to September when you said this, or isn't that exactly what this Democratic president said about something like that? I think it's important in a presidential interview, I would imagine. I haven't done that many of them, to be prepared with the rebuttal questions. And I once interviewed Obama in a tight squeeze. We had very little time, and he was talking about how in healthcare, it was a healthcare interview, that people I was questioning about the limited degree of cost controls in the Affordable Care Act, that they hadn't done much, I claimed in a question, to bring down the cost of medical care. And he said, well, people are not going to just want to have medical tests that they don't need so that they won't have them. And he went on further. And I remember interrupting rather rudely to raise the case of mammography. At that point, new guidelines had just come out saying you shouldn't get a mammogram that often. And people protested and said, they want to take away protection. And I remember feeling we're sitting in the Oval Office. It's kind of hard to interrupt the President of the United States.
He did not like to be interrupted.
I don't think he showed any pleasure at that moment. He said, well, that was the way that was rolled out. And this is not a president whom whose intelligence I would question at all. But I think you have to go in there knowing your stuff and be prepared to challenge what's being said to you. And it's not easy. I have great respect for people who do it quite well.
Who do you think does it well?
First of all, Russert used to do it very well. Let me put in a post-mortem praise for Tim Russert. I think that Dickerson is a very good interviewer, no nonsense, well prepared interviewer, and I admire his talent at doing that. I'm losing CNN in my head right now as I'm talking to you. You know,
Jake Tapper.
Jake, I think Tapper does a very tough job and a good job.
Go to the flip side of my question. Yeah. Talk about the interviews you've enjoyed doing the most and why.
I've enjoyed doing lots of interviews with creative people, people who write, people who act, people who make movies and direct for the theater. I find their stories about how they came to do what they're doing and how they learn, how they approach their craft and their work they're fascinating. I always enjoyed interviewing very old people. I felt that they had no longer any incentive to lie about anything, and those could be very honest, interesting, revealing interviews. I remember those interviews a lot better than what a particular member of Congress said about what his committee was likely to do the next.
Let me go back to your career a bit. Why radio?
I got involved in radio in college, and I liked doing it.
But most of your friends were joining the Columbia Spectator.
I didn't type well enough, I thought, to work for the Spectator. I was going to do some extracurricular activity because I was commuting to college, and someone had said, do something.
There's the headline, by the way.
Yeah.
Siegel went to NPR because he couldn't type.
Because I couldn't type.
I got a little news nugget out of this.
And then at various times, it occurred to me, I'd better get real about this. There just aren't good, interesting jobs in radio here. I guess I should do television. I should do something in television. So I went to journalism school for that purpose. And I was totally turned off by television. I mean, I thought it was – I was amazed by anyone who could get any serious work done in television because of the challenges of the medium. It's a picture medium. Radio, on the other hand, I was kind of reaffirmed in my love of radio that there it was me and a Sony cassette machine, not me and a team of people who would go out with a 16-millimeter camera. So I hung around, and when a radio station opened up doing news and talk, I went to work there.
Is that when they forced you to change your name?
Yes, I was.
What was up with that?
Well, it was something to the effect of that while the owner of the station, Mr. Beck, is himself of the Hebraic, we don't like to have names that are going to offend anybody.
And you were Bob.
I was Bob.
Hard to picture.
No, you know what happened is if you're – maybe you had this with being Jeff. I don't know. I was raised always being called Robert. I was always Robert in my family, or Rob. And then at some point, in my teenage years, it was a choice. I would either accept the fact that everyone I met addressed me as Bob, or I'd have to become the guy who says, please don't call me Bob, call me Robert. And that seemed like a pain in the neck. So I succumbed to peer pressure.
Right. But you recovered it.
I recovered it at a very specific moment. When the Senate debated the Panama Canal treaties, NPR had supposedly committed to carrying this debate gavel to gavel, which was the idea that Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia had. Linda Wertheimer sat in the gallery overlooking the Senate floor, and I sat at home at the studio doing the quorum calls and the breaks in between the debate. And I figured that right now, the number of people who will hear me say my name when we begin this broadcast will be a significant multiple of all the people who've ever heard me say my name before. So it's now or never. And I reclaimed my name as Robert.
Made the switch.
I became Robert Siegel.
When did you first start sounding like Robert Siegel? I mean, when you were a kid, were you?
No. No.
Were you playing stickball and giving running commentary in a Robert Siegel
voice?
No,
I was playing. Well, we actually played more punch ball than stickball where I came from. Eh? But still, the Spalding was the same. In the end of my the last couple of weeks at NPR, a very good producer named Melissa Gray, who is quite gifted and very funny, was assigned the job that I dubbed being my personal obituarist, in that she would prepare pieces about what I had done at NPR. And so she went listening through to stuff that I had done.
It's like watching your eulogy get written.
Exactly. And
from a practical perspective, you might as well be involved in your eulogy writing, right?
That's why not? And what I figured out from listening to all of the old things that that Melissa dredged up was that I sound today pretty much the way I have sounded for the past 16 years or something like that. Before that, I sound very different.
What caused the shift, and what was it like before? Describe it
well,
for our
well,
listeners.
Before I sounded much tighter and more nasal and more, I think, more imitative.
Urgent?
Yeah.
FME kind? I mean—
Not FME.
Not
FME. More AME.
AME. That's what I meant.
And we did.
I don't know if that description means anything to people under 40.
No.
AM or FM.
My daughters who sort of straddled that age mark, for them, my listening to ball games on AM radio is about as bizarre as it was to me that
That's
my
like
father had
cave
a short
paintings,
wave. Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Totally.
He's so, painting his cave again.
Right. It makes no sense to people under a certain age.
Right. Do you think a soothing voice makes people you're interviewing tell you more?
I don't know. That's a good question. When I've been out in the field as a reporter interviewing people, I think there's a lot of bedside manner that goes into those conversations. And when people talk about their lives, maybe it is. Certainly if I started barking at them, you know, and announcing at them like somebody on the radio.
That would be stealing my technique. the barking part.
Well, I think, I've... One thing I come away from all these decades is one of the major forces, it seems, of modern history is for things becoming less formal. Everything becomes whatever we thought was normal 30 years ago feels stiff, you know, by now. And whatever we're doing now, God only knows what people will sound like in another 30 years. But I think there are older broadcasters who can address people in their work the way they will address the camera, which is
right. We'll be back with more of Robert Siegel after the break.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
About just for a minute, NPR. I want to talk about one unpleasant bit, and then a couple of pleasant bits. The unpleasant bit, well, it's not unique to NPR. Obviously, it's this revolution in gender relations, and the exposure of some people, even at NPR, who were behaving in ways unacceptable to their colleagues. One of the things that surprised me is that. While it didn't come as a shock that the Weinstein Company would have this problem, I have a particular, perhaps idealized image of NPR, where I'm surprised anytime that this problem emerges in public radio, but we've seen it over and over again in the last few months. Can you diagnose this?
First, I think I may have had the same idealized view of NPR that you had, mine from inside, when we had an all-staff meeting after our top editor was dispatched for misbehavior, I was surprised by the intensity of the anger and the resentment of especially young women on the staff of NPR. For not having been protected, for people not having acted sooner, and I was surprised by the degree of anger and distress. So I've had to think about it since. First of all, we're not immune to this to the same things that are happening elsewhere.
Were you unaware of this
I was told by a woman colleague who's a very close friend, you know, that there was a complaint against our senior news editor. I assumed, I guess wrongly, that the complaint would be acted on. Someone would read him the Riot Act, and there'd be apologies, and let's get on with it, and no more such behavior.
Talking about Mike Oreskes.
Mike Oreskes, yeah, he was doing a very good job as the senior vice president of news, I guess was the title. And two women whom he had interviewed or had interviewed for jobs with him or about their jobs with him back in his days at the New York Times came to NPR to complain about his past behavior. Which, of course, raises this odd question of, well, we were two employers down the road from this. That is, he had gone from the New York Times to the Associated Press and then to us. I guess people were discreet. You asked me earlier about this time in the news, and is this a time when you want to stop? Meaning, the Trump administration is embroiled in allegations of collusion with the Russians during the campaign. The other running story of the past several weeks has been this, who's the awful guy of the week, whom we'll right now hear a couple of stories about, and. While I guess there's some justice to it, and it strikes closer to home, oddly, than the high politics of the country, I find it a very unpleasant story. It's been a pretty upsetting time, and I hope that men are afraid of the consequences of their misbehaving. I do think that. There will be men who have impulses, so long as people enjoy power at the workplace, they may try to abuse it. So I don't hope for a complete rebirth of human goodness and kindness, but rather of restraints against bad behavior and feeling that there'll be some penalty for doing wrong.
Right.
It's very Jewish of me to say that, I think.
Bob Charles has no views on that, obviously, yeah. From an outside perspective.
Yeah.
Go to the good bits.
Yeah.
And this is hard for you in one sense, because I believe, as do others, that you were built by NPR, but you also helped build NPR in some real ways. I just want you to frame out NPR's role in journalism and in society today compared to 40 years ago. Yeah. I mean, one of the astonishing things about NPR is that we think often of the nightly newscasts or the cable news shows as driving the national conversation. All things considered, as more listeners than nearly all television news shows have viewers, I think. NPR combined, yeah, certainly, morning and night, is an extraordinary presence, but it's a lower key presence in a kind of way.
Well, its influence has grown enormously. When I went to work at NPR at the end of 1976, there were probably a couple of dozen people in NPR News,
That's amazing.
Yeah. All but one of them worked in Washington. We had a reporter in New York. That was about it. We had 10 reporters all told, I think. I was originally a newscaster, but we were growing so rapidly that every 6 months my job would change and I was moved up to being an editor. So I and a very gifted guy named Robert Krolwich edited the 10 reporters that we had or whatever. And we were moving into a vacant space. Radio had been killed off by television. And all the companies that owned the big radio stations and big radio networks also owned big television properties and decided at some point, even when, 98% of Americans would tune into the radio every day, decided that the future was in television. and that radio could more efficiently be reduced to a single program format operation that would play all top 40 music or all middle-of-the-road music or maybe all news, maybe all news. We had a tremendous technological advantage as well. At the end of the Second World War, FM radio became available to the public. It was a new invention. There was a rule that the stations wanted lobbying for, which was to pass a law that would make it's a strange law. It would make an FM radio standard equipment rather than optional in a car. Mm. This is 1978, I think. There was no such law ever passed, but it became practice after a while. Until that time, most cars didn't have FM radios. And I'd say for the first 30 years or so of NPR's life, the technological landscape tilted our way radically because there was still a tremendous amount of radio listening, but it was moving every year more and more from AM to FM. Then I think there came a time when we benefited once again from a bad decision, which was that in exchange essentially for being deregulated, everyone could say, well, look, NPR, people will find lots of news on the air. It's on NPR. Don't hold us to any high standard to do original journalism on the radio. It's been a completely organic experience. That is, when I went to work there in 76, people did say that there was going to be a morning program started down the road at some point, but no one ever had this plan of what it is we were going to become. We weren't conceived of as a grown up. We were always this child growing up. By 9/11, I remember realizing that we had more full-time foreign correspondents than the television networks did.
Right. When you really move toward indispensability.
You think? Yeah. When you're suddenly being attacked by strange groups hiding out in the mountains of Afghanistan, you're not going to be able to just ask your next door neighbor what's with this. You need some kind of authority that knows something about this to talk to you about such things.
Right. We came back into history then at a moment, and that required the services of NPR.
The summer was all about the summer of before 9/11 was all about shark attacks and the death of an intern on Capitol Hill in Washington. These were the stories that people were obsessing over.
Where do you think it goes? Is everything just going to be a podcast soon? God willing.
God willing. I think that we're turning into a kind of an audio associated press. That is, when I first came to NPR, I mean, I can tell you these, how small NPR in Washington was. But if you looked at how many public radio stations out there could assign a reporter to a story and have a story done for the network that day, the number we could count on our fingers, and maybe not need the second hand. Today, I mean, there are lots of stations out there that are the biggest broadcast newsroom in their city, and that have really good reporters, and that also have very good relations with the good newspaper reporters where they are. And our role as a national system of news gathering is really growing. So I think that's there in the future. Podcasting, it's very interesting. The idea of radio has always been, well, we'll put a program on our biggest program. We'll put it on a time when we know that most people are turning on their radios. Morning and afternoon drive, we would have said, drive time. I enjoy the notion of the same thing being on the air for people all across the country and hearing that at the same time. There's still that sense of community about it. And the podcast is obviously a more individualistic thing. It's saying here, you make your own decision when you want to listen to this and when you want to fast forward or turn off this boring guest that Jeff has on you.
Just do me a favor and say the words, I'm Robert Siegel and this is the Atlantic Interview.
I'm Robert Siegel and this is the Atlantic Interview.
So you could have my job. I think I've
cracked the code right there.
I think you have a retirement plan.
You think so?
I think you have a post-retirement plan. Yeah, you're free to come here and have a podcast.
Yeah.
What is the next step? You're certainly not retiring per se.
Well, I mean, I don't. I'm right now. I'm living purposely without purpose or plan. You know, I'm just. I really has been since I was.
You're
about
so zen.
20. Well, when I was about 22, and didn't know what was going to happen. I remember several months, just not working and living, writing, trying to write, but not working. And that's the only period of my life since I was about 15 that I experienced that. And now
you're not suggesting that you just want to enjoy yourself for a while.
I want to try this. I want to try this first and see what that feels like, and see what it feels good to do.
Yeah. When a person of power and influence, and millions of people know your voice, they don't know your face necessarily, but they know your voice. When a person of influence retires, does that person fear irrelevance as much as they fear simply the aging process?
I don't know that I fear irrelevance. I think there's something special about retiring from the kind of job that I've been doing, which is that, as you say, people don't know me. They know my voice. The relationship of a radio listener to the people whom they hear every day is a very special, close relationship. And, you know, we always have been, I think the BBC was the first to say back in the, who knows when, listen to radio, the pictures are better, meaning they're in your head. So, people have their own perception of me, and retirement from a broadcasting job, I think, is a little different from retirement. I think it's different from retirement from other kinds of work, because it's like slipping out of a skin that has never been entirely me. It's been a combination of me and people's whatever meaning they've attached to listening to me on the radio. So I don't that character, that the persona that I am as a host of a radio program that meant something to people, I'm shedding and I cease to be. But
so when you go to Safeway a year from now, you'll be just as anonymous as you were a year ago.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that makes it easier.
Now, I've seen, you know, I know television people when I've walked down the street and, you know, people's heads turn, you can see them being recognized by everyone. I've always enjoyed, people in radio enjoy a certain amount of anonymity. But I think that the separation from being the afternoon voice of public radio is, I suspect, a little different from many people's retirement, in that there's a distance between me and saying this is All Things Considered from NPR News several times a day.
But admit it, when you go into a store and you do open your mouth, the kind of the game's up a little bit, no?
It depends what store. It depends what depends what level of
the NPR store, for instance.
The NPR store, they know me very well. They sell socks with my name on them. I think it must be different from. Although I assume that when the local general practitioner retires and ceases to be the person you see for healing, there's a separation between profession and identity. But in this case, there's something imagined about the identity that I have in people's minds that I'm sort of half responsible for. They're also responsible for it. So. I find the separation for me right now. I mean, you're talking to me on day one of my retirement, but I find it a little kind of healthy. I mean, I understand that that I won't have the same relationship to strangers that I used to have.
To the extent that people have ever said to you, "Oh, I didn't picture you looking this way." What do they picture you looking like? 6'5".
I've had this joke for decades where I talk to people at station gatherings, and I always have this the same shtick where I'll say, we know there are always millions of people out there listening, but when we do the program, we just look at the engineer or the director. So it's nice to actually see the people in the audience, and then I'll pause and say. And I'm always struck when I say this, that you don't look anything like what I thought you would look like. And then I'd say, I thought you'd all be taller and have more hair. Usually at the end of every such evening, someone would come up to me at the end and say, you know, it's funny because you don't look like what I thought you would look like.
Somebody doesn't get the joke.
Somebody always doesn't
get the joke.
But as I've told all of my colleagues, that joke is also retiring now in 2018. So.
Well, I wish it a happy retirement.
Thank you very much.
Robert Siegel.
Jeff Goldberg. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. No, thank you.
Thank you. I said Groucho Marx.
That's right. Robert Siegel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Atlantic Interview is produced by Diana Douglas. Wait, that's my almost... I almost sounded like Robert Siegel.
Back announced, take two. The Atlantic Interview is produced by Diana Douglas and Kevin Townsend with production help from Kim Lau. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe and rate us. If you don't like it and you're still listening, we'll have another podcast for you to dislike next week. He's Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief. See you next week.